Early in 2015, a triple murder in the college community of Chapel Hill led to a global outpouring of support. WUNC reporters and hosts followed the tragedy from the morning after the shooting around the globe as a community mourned and tried to carry on the legacy of the three victims.
Police say a parking dispute led a Chapel Hill man to shoot and kill three young people last night. The victims were Muslims, and the shootings have sent shockwaves around the world. The suspect, Craig Stephen Hicks, appeared in Durham County Court this morning. WUNC's Jorge Valencia has been following the story today and joins us now. And Jorge, what do we know about what actually happened last night?
Well, what we know for sure, what's coming officially from the police, is that they believe that Craig Hicks, who lives in a community about a mile away from the University of North Carolina campus.
Hundreds of people bow their heads as a college student recites verses from the Quran. Some are in tears, others holding candles silently. They're standing at the center of campus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I thank you all for coming here. I literally can't even see the end of the crowd. My family thanks you for coming here.
Fadis Barakat is the older brother of Dia Barakat, one of the victims. Dia's 21-year-old wife, Yusra Abu-Salha, and her sister, Razan Abu-Salha, were also shot to death on Tuesday in their apartment. Fadis tells the crowd of friends and supporters that he wants them to remember their legacy.
And take the message my mom wanted to make public, and do not fight fire with fire.
He says that if, in fact, the incident was...
This is Morning Edition. I'm Eric Hodge. When three young Muslim people were killed in a Chapel Hill apartment last week, their families and friends said they knew why, and advocates around the world agreed. They said their neighbor shot them because he hated their religion. Local police didn't deny that claim, but they didn't validate it either. They initially said the neighbor was disgruntled over a parking space. Jorge Valencia reports on the difference between establishing a hate crime in a courtroom and in the court of public opinion.
A hate crime is a crime committed on account of a person's race, religion, or some other protected status. But just why do we have this designation in our legal system?
American society at all levels, judicial, legislative, and presidential, has found that invidious discrimination is anathema to our nation's laws and values.
Brian Levin is an expert on this. He oversees the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He says the point of hate crime laws is to recognize when a crime affects not just individual victims, but also the community to which they belong. Yet prosecutors nationwide don't often use hate crime statutes in murders, like last week's shooting of Razan Abu-Salha, Yusur Abu-Salha, and Dia Barakat. That's because it's easier to prove only...
Dia and Yusur were going to become dentists, and Razan an architect. Principal Jabin says the days following the incident were tough for everyone, even the youngest students.
I remember some parents came and asked me to talk to them because they were having nightmares and they were scared that their brothers and their sisters may not come back home in the evening when it's too late.
Jabin told the students not to worry, that the three are in a good place.
And you keep doing what you're doing and feel proud about yourself.
On Jabin's wrist are three bright green bands. On them are the names of Dia, Yusur, and Razan. Practically everyone in this school wears them, including sixth grader Suhaila Bukharfi and Noor Asfour. They're inside, working on a service project.
And it basically shows the date that they passed away.
And also they have shirts for them.
Do y'all wear these green bands every day?
Yeah, a lot of people do, because it just shows that we actually care about what happened.
Along with other students, the two best friends are busy...
Today, the suspect in February's Chapel Hill shooting is set to appear in court. Craig Stephen Hicks has been charged with first-degree murder. During the investigation, police officers found about a dozen firearms in Hicks' apartment. They include pistols, shotguns, and one AR-15 assault rifle. Criminologists say there's a national trend. While the percentage of Americans with guns is decreasing, those who do own weapons are accumulating more of them. Jorge Valencia reports from Chapel Hill.
It's not easy to find someone who owns a lot of guns and is willing to talk about them. I asked my neighbor, I asked a firearms lobbyist, I went to a couple of gun stores. They explained to me, gun owners are private about what they own because they don't want to make it easier for thieves or for the government to find their guns.
My name is John Landreth. I live in Chapel Hill, and I'm a merchandiser.
It actually kind of feels like I've spotted Bigfoot, almost.
Well, a Bigfoot is not an adequate description of me. Maybe a big mouth.
Landreth lives in a rural part of Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And he likes talking about his cat, that he would raise $20,000.
And I kind of said, Dia, you have a long way to go, my friend. He said, Daddy, I'm going to try it. I'm going to give it my best.
Dia was still selling toothbrush kits when he, his wife Yusra Abu Salha, and his wife's sister Razan Abu Salha were fatally shot. The project could have ended that day, but Americans and Muslims around the world condemned the shootings as a hate crime. And when people searched Dia's name on the internet, they found a website he put up.
My name is Dia Barakat. I'm a dental student at UNC, and I need your help. Have you ever felt helpless about the situation in Syria and felt like you can't do anything about it? Well, this is your opportunity to help. This
summer, people donated more than $500,000, and Dia's friends and family had decided they would continue mapping out what Dia named Project Refugee Smiles. Here's Ferris.
I remember moving out his stuff from the apartment, and there was like a sheet of paper there about the trip, like all the things he wanted to do. Like there was something there about educating the patients about dental hygiene. Like there's all these, like he had such a calculated and invested approach to this.
In late July, Ferris, his father, and more than 40 American Muslim volunteers set out for Project Refugee Smiles. They included relatives, friends Dia had encouraged to study dentistry, and people from across the U.S. who never met him. From Istanbul, the group flew 90 minutes to Hatay province, which borders the Mediterranean on one side and Syria to the other. From the airport, it was a 45-minute bus ride to the clinic in Rihanli, a busy crossing point with Syria.
Ahmed, do you want to see Syria? That's the border. You see the barbed wire? That's Syria right there.
The brown and olive hills in Syria look no different than the ones in Turkey. You can see them from the highway, and you can see them from the school that hosts the clinic.
For the second year in a row, coal ash continued to be an environmental policy and economic story our listeners followed. State lawmakers continued to debate what should be done with the potentially toxic carbon byproduct as a neighbor demonstrated how cleanup can happen.
Today is the anniversary of the Dan River coal ash spill. Since that day, politicians, scientists, environmentalists, and Duke Energy officials have weighed in on how to handle a problem very few knew existed before the spill. Dave DeWitt looks back at the year in coal ash and at the 100-million-ton crisis ahead.
In retrospect, running a storm pipe under an unlined coal ash pit was a bad idea. But a week or so after the leak was first discovered, Duke Energy spokesman Jeff Brooks wasn't quite ready to admit that.
It was not a design that we placed in our other plants, certainly, and it was not the original design of the plant, so it's something that we'll have to look at in our investigation.
It would take nearly a week to plug the hole and stop the thick gray sludge from flowing into the Dan River. But not before 39,000 tons of coal ash and tens of millions of gallons of contaminated water created a toxic gray blanket of muck that flowed 70 miles downstream. A few months after the leak, Senate leader Phil Berger, who lives in Eden, just a few miles from the shuttered Dan River power plant, had introduced a bill to deal with the coal ash problem.
This is the most comprehensive and far-reaching coal ash regulation bill in the nation.
Berger isn't likely ever to be confused with an environmentalist, but he led an effort to reject the House version of the bill he said was too lenient. When his bill finally passed and became law without Governor Pat McCrory's signature, it ordered Duke to clean up coal ash pits at all 14 sites across the state within 15 years. It also created the Coal Ash Management Commission to offer recommendations for those closures. What it didn't do was say who was going to pay for it all. Duke Energy estimates it could cost $10 billion.
And while there's been a lot of political activity around the issue, no coal ash has been moved in North Carolina. As Dave DeWitt reports, that's not the case with one of our neighbors.
A few days after the General Assembly passed the Coal Ash Management Act last fall, Governor Pat McCrory recorded a video and made a claim many in his Republican Party have since proudly repeated.
This bill makes North Carolina the national leader in acknowledging and attacking the coal ash problem that has been building for more than a half a century.
Acknowledging and attacking hasn't so far led to any moving of coal ash. And as far as being a national leader, it's actually one of our neighbors, South Carolina, that may lay a better claim, says Frank Holloman, an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center.
That Coal Ash Management Act has been in place for months, and as of today, not one ounce of ash has been moved as a result of that act. Meanwhile, the ash and pollution is being cleaned up in South Carolina and has been cleaned up in South Carolina for years.
Duke Energy operates in both states. In North Carolina, it is by far the dominant utility and has about 120 million tons of coal ash. In South Carolina, it's one of three main utility companies and has around 10 million. Erin Colbert is a spokeswoman for Duke Energy.
So North Carolina is vastly bigger in scope and in scale, but it's also, of course, the location where the Dan River ash release occurred last February. And that has spurred North Carolina legislators to pass a very complex new state law.
Colbert says a more simplified regulatory environment in South Carolina makes it easier to get coal ash moved there. The South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control, along with the Southern Environmental Law Center and the three main utilities that operate in the state, struck an agreement to get nearly all coal ash moved to lined landfills. Some of it is being moved already. Holloman praises what has happened in South Carolina and says citizen lawsuits brought by the SELC have moved things along there. And he says there's another reason why it hasn't happened here.
There were moments of civil disobedience, late-night policymaking, and visits from reality stars turned presidential frontrunners. Our Capitol Bureau team kept up with the state government.
We are North Carolina! We are North Carolina!
Dozens of people raised their fists, held posters, and shouted. It was a familiar sight as far as protests go.
Sin papeles, sin miedo!
But this one was bilingual, and all of a sudden, six people walked onto the street and locked their arms together with plastic traps. A man locked their ankles with chains.
Out of the street, folks! Out of the street!
Raleigh police officers quickly pushed most of the protesters onto the sidewalk. But the six in chains sat in the middle of the street in front of the state's executive mansion. They were angry about a bill Governor Pat McCrory signed into law this week. It includes the following two provisions. It makes it illegal for city councils to instruct their police officers to not ask people about their immigration status. And it tells local governments that they can't accept ID cards issued by consulates or nonprofit organizations as a form of identification.
McCrory didn't want
to listen to us.
Carmen Rodriguez and Angelina Echeverria were two of the six locked down.
We spent a month standing there right where you are.
Pasando frío.
Suffered cold.
Bajo la lluvia.
Under the rain.
A few dozen turned out almost every day since the Republican-led General Assembly sent the Republican governor the bill at the end of September. He signed it this week at the Guilford County Sheriff's Office.
We have gang violence that continues to go up, sometimes because of international gangs. We have schools that are becoming overcrowded. We have drug trafficking. We have hospital emergency rooms that are often flowing.
93 having voted in the affirmative and 23 in the negative. House Bill 97 passes its third reading. The amendments are ordered engrossed and will be sent to the Senate.
More on the Senate in a moment.
But first, the budget that passed. Let's hear some perspectives from both sides of the aisle. Here's Republican Craig Horn of Union County.
Is it perfect? We've all heard the phrase, don't sacrifice the good for the perfect. It's not perfect. Lots of room to grow, lots of challenges ahead. And I choose to look forward to what the Senate's going to do with this budget and take it even better.
And here's the minority party leader, Democrat Larry Hall from Durham.
It's a low bar, but I hope at least we can try to attain it throughout this budget process. I'm voting against the budget because I don't think status quo is good enough.
Some of Hall's chief complaints this week were focused really on education. For 6 months, the billionaire mogul has delivered a relentless stream of put-downs, personality, and promises that have propelled him comfortably atop the Republican presidential race. For 52 minutes last night, he was center stage in Dorton Arena on the state fairgrounds.
People say, why do you always mention polls? Because I'm always number one in the polls for you. For you, right?
His visit came the same day as a national CNN poll showing Trump with 36% support from registered Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. Despite some pundits doubting his long-term viability, Trump's lead continues to grow, now 20 points.
We have become so politically correct that we don't know what the hell we're doing. We don't know what.
Trump talked about interrogation.
And I said, can we go a couple of steps beyond waterboarding?
Education.
Common Core is a disaster.
Holiday greetings.
We are going to bring Merry Christmas back to our schools.
And at least a dozen other issues. He spoke for about half an hour before taking questions from the crowd of several thousand.
I was wondering what you would say to President Obama.
You're fired.
WUNC serves as home base for the American Homefront Project, a national military reporting partnership with KUOW and KPCC. Jay Price reports extensively about issues on base as well as in veteran communities.
22 veterans a day commit suicide. That's according to a 2013 VA study. But the reality behind that number and what it's doing to the way we think about younger veterans isn't simple. Jay Price reports as part of the American Homefront Project.
22, not something vague or rounded off, not 30, not 20, 22. A number so specific it inspires instant credibility and action.
A retired Marine vet has walked more than 1,000 miles.
There have been lots of news stories this summer about Toby Flaggett, who is walking from Oregon to New Jersey wearing a T-shirt that says 22 is 22 too many.
The police officer and Marine Corps veteran stopped in Clinton, Iowa Wednesday, hoping to raise awareness about the problem of veteran suicide.
People don't want to talk about it, but it's a real problem.
Every day, 22 veterans commit suicide.
And almost weekly, there are other walks, swims, and runs dedicated to that number. Street corner rallies on the 22nd of each month, and 22-kilometer marches in California and Texas led by shirtless Marines in short shorts carrying packs that weigh 22 kilograms. And the statistic has inspired more than just physical challenges.
Now today, we lose 22 veterans a day to suicide.
That's President Obama at a national mental health conference in 2013.
Mr. President, every day, approximately 22 American veterans commit suicide.
And that's Senator John McCain on the Senate floor earlier this year, endorsing the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act. It was named after a veteran of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars who killed himself. But as it turns out, 22 a day has little to do with veterans of those wars. Iraq combat veteran Keith Jennings is a clinical psychologist who studies suicide prevention and acts as chief science advisor for a Durham-based group called StopSoldierSuicide.org.
That number, we talk about it out of context, it's questionable.
And there's a lot of context. Jennings says the 22 research was a Herculean effort by good scientists, but that it's often...
There's a construction boom underway in veteran cemeteries. The government is building more of them now than at any time since the Civil War. Both in North Carolina and other states, the projects are bringing cemeteries closer to hundreds of thousands of veterans. As part of WUNC's American Homefront Project, Jay Price reports from Goldsboro.
Eternal rest. People usually expect that theirs will be peaceful, but not the ones who want to be buried in this cemetery now under construction in Goldsboro. That's kind of the whole point. North Carolina's newest state veterans cemetery is right under the flight path of Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, and there's a large local population of veterans. Teresa West, who helps oversee the four cemeteries run by the State Division of Veterans Affairs, tries to describe this one.
So on my right side here is the administration building. As you can see from the architecture, it looks like airplane wings since we're close to the base here. And all of our cemeteries are different as far as architecture, so I think this one's very special.
A few miles away, in a mobile home park just off a country two lane, is one of those local veterans who isn't troubled by the idea of eternally howling jet turbines over his gravesite.
Okay, my name is Michael Burris, and I'm 68.
Burris is sitting on his couch with his walker and an array of pill bottles within reach. He served a bloody tour north of Saigon as an Army medic during the peak of the Vietnam War.
And WUNC's newscasts serve as a hub for these stories, gathering local, national, and international news stories of interest to our listeners.
It's 8:04. Good morning. I'm Eric Hodge. This is news from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Scientists from Duke and UNC are among those winning the Nobel Prize for Chemistry today. Paul Modrich of Duke and Aziz Sanyar from UNC were part of a trio of researchers who discovered how cells repair damaged DNA. The Nobel Committee said the work can be used to develop new cancer treatments. Governor Babicori says the state is helping South Carolina following this weekend's storms. North Carolina deployed National Guard members and four Black Hawk helicopters to help with relief efforts in Columbia. Babicori says the focus here now turns to farmers, some of whom have had crops decimated.
It is of great concern to us and their families and to the economy of North Carolina at this point in time. So we're talking about mainly peanut, sweet potatoes, and cotton.
Federal and state assistance could be made available to farmers in the coming weeks. Raleigh elected Mayor Nancy McFarland to a third term yesterday. Councilman Eugene Weeks lost to AT&T technical manager Corey Branch, who will now represent District C in Southeast Raleigh. And in Northeast Raleigh, District B Councilman John Odom lost to researcher David Cox. The UNC Board of Governors is holding a series of meetings starting today to consider candidates for system president. Dave DeWitt reports.
The two meetings will take place behind closed doors. Candidates are purposely kept secret until a final vote by the Board of Governors. Several Board of Governors members who are not on the search committee have expressed frustration with the lack of information on the candidates. An effort to make the process more public failed to pass in the General Assembly. The full board will likely take a final vote on the next UNC president at its meeting on October 30th. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Plenty of sunshine today, highs in the mid to upper 70s. This is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.